Welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I am your host, Jonathan. Well, today is the final installment in our series on the Axeman, who started his bloody trail back in 1910. We left off in 1911, so let's get back into it. After the attack on the Davies from our last episode, the attacks from the mysterious Axeman, or the Cleaver, as he was called by the local newspapers, just kind of dropped off the radar entirely. Police thought the person they'd been after was most likely arrested for a lesser crime, like a burglary, and was in jail. Now, that could be true. We don't know. The reality may also be that this was a cooling off period for the Axeman, and quite a lengthy one at that. In December of 1917, 6 years after the last attack, the Axeman returned. Epifanio and Anna Andalina, a Sicilian couple, ran a grocery store about 4 miles west of Vieux-Carré in Carrollton. As with previous victims, the Andalina's grocery store also served as a bar, and the living quarters were attached. And, much like the other attacks, the Axeman used a railroad pin to break in through the kitchen. What was different this time was the presence of children. At 3 a.m., the Andalina's daughter, Mary, heard her mother scream to get the rest of the children out of the house. The daughter took the younger children and hurried them into the street while Mrs. Andalina took her infant and joined her. Mr. Andalina, unfortunately, had been struck 5 times with a hatchet, and the Axeman attacked their 2 boys by hitting them with the butt of his gun. Also a new addition to his arsenal. The Axeman fled. Once again, the police questioned the family and found out they had no enemies, but the specifics of the attack fit exactly with those 6 years prior. Now, the police force in New Orleans also had a shakeup of its own a few months earlier, one that left the department in disarray and short a few officers. See, a patrolman named Terry Mullen, suffering from known mental health issues, walked into the police headquarters one day and just started firing off rounds on a 10-minute shooting spree, killing Superintendent Jim Reynolds, who, as you may remember, had been investigating the first Axeman attacks and was, up until that fatal day, trying to apprehend the killer. The man to take Jim Reynolds' place was Frank Mooney. Mooney, unfortunately, hadn't been involved in any of the previous investigations into the Axeman. Another unfortunate move, one of Mooney's first acts in his new position, was to get rid of the Night Detective Bureau, putting the police department and the city of New Orleans at large at a huge disadvantage when it came to future attacks. In May of 1918, the police received a call from someone complaining that his brother and his brother's wife had been murdered. The police arrived at the residence of Joseph and Catherine Maggio, whose home was attached to, you guessed it, a grocery store slash saloon. Both had been brutally attacked with an axe. Catherine had been dead for hours when the detectives arrived, and Joseph, barely clinging on, died before the interns could get him into an ambulance. A woman who worked next door to the Maggios made the discovery, after the murders, of a small razor with a tortoiseshell handle and notified the police. The new evidence gave the police a lead, or so they thought. Find the owner of the razor, and you can find the murderer. The razor, led them to Andrew Maggio's barbershop. Andrew was the brother of the recently deceased Joseph Maggio. The police grilled Andrew and then searched his place. They found more razors identical to the one discovered at the crime scene, but, you know, since Andrew was a barber, he really had more reason than most people to have a collection of razors in his apartment. You know, what was curious was a white shirt they found in Andrew's bathroom. You know, it was crumpled up. It looked like Andrew had attempted to wash it the night before. And upon closer inspection, the police found red stains on the shirt. The police decided that this was the time to close in on Andrew and give him the third degree. They questioned him intensely, and Andrew kept repeating his story over and over again without any deviation. When the police finally confronted him about why he didn't hear the murders taking place that night, he told them that it was because he'd been out drinking. Those red stains on his shirt were, in fact, wine. And the police were once again back at square one. The papers, in the meantime, fell back to their old story that the Axeman murders were most likely a mafia hit. However, the police back then, as well as anyone studying the Axeman murders today, knows that using an axe, or hatchet, or cleaver, or razor, I guess, is extremely inefficient. It's very difficult to carry out one murder, let alone attempt to wipe out two or more people. If this was a gang hit, a gun would have been much more efficient. The attacks weren't motivated by greed, because the Axeman rarely took much, if anything, and didn't hang around to explore the residences. No. The Axeman wanted to be up close and personal with his victims. In June of 1918, a mysterious person entered the residence of the Bessemers and attacked them with an axe. In this case, both survived. No money had been taken, and the path of the crime, starting at the kitchen and ending in the bedrooms, certainly fit the profile of the Axeman. The Bessemer's residence was attached to a grocery store. However, the Bessemers were not Italian, and they were not Sicilian. The Bessemers were taken in for questioning so they could give their statements to the police. Mr. Bessemer told the police that he was Polish. Mrs. Bessemer, however, told the police that her husband was German, though he didn't tell people that he was. You have to remember that in June of 1918, we were still in the throes of World War I, and anti-German sentiment spread throughout the U.S. and, yes, even New Orleans. In fact, the citizens, the newspapers, and even the police of New Orleans were not immune to this type of prejudice. While Mr. Bessemer may indeed have been Polish and born into a German-controlled territory, he was still, quote-unquote, German in the eyes of everyone in New Orleans. When Mr. Bessemer sent a bathrobe to his wife in the hospital, the police went so far as to rip out the lining in case Mr. Bessemer sent any secret messages. Even agents of the Federal Department of Justice were interested in Mr. Bessemer and picked him up to question him about possible connections to foreign espionage, but found nothing. Despite all of this, Mr. Bessemer wanted to take an active part in the investigation and find the attacker. And not in the same way as, say, O.J. Simpson is still looking for that mysterious killer, but because he genuinely wanted the Axeman to be brought to justice. Later that summer, in August, the Axeman struck again. This time, it was the Bruno house. Lily Bruno and her daughters lived with Joe Bruno, Lily's brother. One of her daughters, Rosie, ran a small grocery store in the front of the house. At 3 a.m., Joe Bruno came stumbling out of his bedroom, groaning and holding a bloody wound on his head. The attacker left the axe in Joe's bedroom. The Brunos were not well off by any means. In fact, they did not even have a phone and had to use their neighbor's phone to call an ambulance. The severity of the wound caused Joe Bruno to die shortly after he was picked up. This murder, for whatever reason, sent the city of New Orleans into a panic. Gun sales soared. People formed neighborhood watches, or something resembling them, but with a bit more inclination for local justice. People started sleeping during the day and standing guard in their own homes at night. Families started sleeping in shifts. Axeman sightings started popping up all over the city. There were other people who were also willing to capitalize on the fear and chaos caused by the Axeman. Axeman-like burglaries were occurring against Italian and non-Italian grocery stores. Even the Piggly Wiggly, not ones to miss an opportunity to advertise, announced their new self-service grocery store by taking out an ad in the Times-Picayune that stated, "The Axeman will appear in this city on Saturday, August 24th. He will ruthlessly use the Piggly Wiggly axe in cutting off the heads of all high-priced grocery stores." But this shameless marketing stunt wasn't to be the last made in the Axeman's name. In Sunday, March 13th, 1919, the Times-Picayune printed the infamous letter from the Axeman that I read aloud at the start of this series. For those who want to hear it, just go back and listen to the first installment. Like, seriously, do it. Stop this podcast, go listen to the first few minutes of episode one, and then come back here. We'll be waiting. So, the letter itself was obviously not written by the Axeman just by looking at it. The language is flowery, and it has highbrow references to mythology as well as Jack the Ripper, indirectly. And this was not a threat or taunt to the police like the Son of Sam letters or the various other manifestos that we've seen published by serial killers. In all likelihood, this letter was sent by one Joseph John DeVilva. Now, DeVilva had quite some success at writing songs for vaudeville, and he was quick to step forward, saying the mysterious Axeman's letter inspired him to write yet another piece of music called The Axeman's Jazz. Since the letter threatened to kill anyone who was not playing jazz on a night shortly after the release of the sheet music, which also happened to coincide with St. Joseph's Night, a big observance in the Italian community, DeVilva was leveraging fear to drive sales of his own composition. However, despite the frenzy and the fear, the Axeman seemed to take a holiday on St. Joseph's, and no one suffered from a midnight attack at the hands of the cleaver. It should be noted that the Axeman was not the only unseen killer wreaking havoc throughout the population of New Orleans. From 1918 to 1919, a mutation of the H1N1 virus swept through the country. And just like today with COVID-19, New Orleans was one of the hardest hit areas. Known as the Spanish flu in times when xenophobia infiltrated how we named illnesses, this version of H1N1 saw high mortality rates in people younger than 5 years old, those over 60, and 20 to 40-year-olds. And honestly, I hadn't thought of this aspect of history when I first started researching the Axeman. This was just one of those weird things that made the topic more topical. And I applaud anyone who's listening at this point in the episode, because it's bad enough that we're inundated with news about our, current pandemic, much less one from a little over a century ago. But as the deadly flu's curve flattened and infection became less in New Orleans, the Axeman's attacks increased. But as the police and newspapers were wholly transparent and hyperbolic, respectively, the landscape was rather muddled as to which were true Axeman murders and which ones were just burglars or other criminals pulling off crimes in the style of the Axeman to kind of hide in plain sight. Which leaves us with one big question. Who the hell was the Axeman? The police of New Orleans never did find out, and anyone they arrested under the suspicion of being the Axeman was usually in prison while more murders were committed in the style of the Axeman, which kind of disqualified the people the police pulled in. And the ones they brought to trial simply didn't have enough evidence stacked up against them to link them directly to the crimes. And there were lots of suspects, and even trials. Diving into the minutiae of the arrests and court cases connected to the Axeman would easily turn this into a 10-part series. But just because the Axeman murders stopped in Louisiana in 1919 doesn't mean the Axeman stopped killing. In fact, it seems like he took his act on the road. In 1921, Sicilian grocer Giovanni Orlando, his wife, and small children were found hacked to death by an axe around 70 miles southwest of Alexandria, Louisiana. A few months later, Frank Scalzi was murdered by an axe-wielding fiend in the middle of the night in his home/grocery store in Lake Charles. Now, true crime enthusiasts might want to check out public records in Texas or even north in Illinois to see if there were similar murders in 1920 to 1929. One thing is for certain, the Axeman left New Orleans, but the legend did not. And who knows? Maybe one day we might connect the dots and identify the killer and figure out a motive, much to the chagrin of people looking for haunted tales in our fair city. And that pretty much wraps up our series on the Axeman. It still remains an unsolved case to this day. But as more information becomes available on the internet, I'm sure we can all get together and maybe figure out who this was or where they fled to, track their movements across the country, and find out exactly the fate of the Axeman after all. If you want to take a deeper dive into the details of the murders and the suspects involved in the Axeman killings, I highly recommend you check out The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story by Miriam Davis. Now, I'd like to give a huge shout out to the fine folks of the Tomb of Nick Cage for telling people about this podcast. I haven't picked up a mic to do this kind of thing in about a decade. So knowing that there are people who enjoy the paranormal side of Louisiana is absolute music to my ears. And you all should check out the incredible sounds from the Tomb of Nick Cage while you're at it. I'm a huge fan of horror rock, and odds are you fans out there are too. So check them out now. Buy their album and check out their Bandcamp store. I think Bandcamp is still giving 100% of earnings to the artists, so give them some love. And as always, if you like the podcast, tell your friends or join our Facebook page and check out our community to connect with others who share the penchant for the funny and the macabre. I'd like to remind you all to stay safe, be responsible, and if you want to be irresponsible, as I do, Do it in the privacy of your own home until this thing passes, and then we can all be irresponsible together outdoors. Doing a bunch of research about crime during a flu epidemic in 1918, especially given our current state of affairs, did wear on me a little. So next time, I'm taking y'all on a virtual trip across the river to Mississippi for some good old-fashioned alien abduction. Then, after that, we'll be back in Louisiana for more frighteningly good times. Until then, thanks for listening to the Mothball Prophecies, and sleep tight.